From 9 o'clock this morning, and my wife called to me and said, "It's 9 o'clock and you're not ready." And in irritation, I replied, "These nagging religious women, always dragging their husbands off to church." But really, I'm glad to be here this morning and to share with you some more thoughts about the book of Genesis. And we are in chapter 19. Chapter 19. Let us pray together. Father, we humbly ask that the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. In verse 27 of chapter 19, the city of Sodom is no more. It has become nothing other than a cinder. And we ask ourselves, why was this so? Well, it was so because the city of Sodom had prostituted God's design for his world. In the beginning of creation, God said, "Now let a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they two shall become one flesh. Now go and multiply and replenish the earth." And of course, sodomy destroys the family, and sodomy is non-productive. If sodomy had been permitted by God to spread across the earth, the human race would have died. Therefore, it was necessary that God nip it in the bud. This is what Paul is talking about in Romans chapter 1, when he says God gave them up to uncleanness through the lust of their heart to dishonor their own bodies between themselves. Dishonor. Sodomy is a dishonorable thing. For even their women, and this is lesbianism, even their women did exchange the natural use for that which is against nature. And likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust one toward another. Men with men working that which is unseemly and receiving in themselves that recompense of their error which was fitting. So to sum up, God knew that Sodom would never change, and God fitted the judgment to the crime. In verse 22 of chapter 18 are these words, "And the angels turned and went toward Sodom, but Abraham stood yet before the Lord." Now that's the beginning of the narrative, which gives to us the story of Abraham interceding with God for the city of Sodom, and especially for his nephew Lot. And following that verse, we have the story of the Holocaust which fell upon the city. Then in chapter 19, verse 27, we read these words, "And Abraham gat up early in the morning to the place where he stood before the Lord," which means that after the Holocaust has passed, now Abraham returns to the same place where he had been interceding with God for Sodom before the Holocaust. This was a moment of morning devotion. There is a story which I'm sure I have told you. It bears repeating. One of the favorite characters of the New Testament, in my mind, is Zacchaeus, the little tax collector from Jericho, who climbed up into the sycamore tree to see Jesus as he passed. And as Jesus passed that way and spoke to him, he came down out of the sycamore, received him into his house, and his whole life was transformed. Now, there is a legend about Zacchaeus. The legend is that after his conversion at the tree in Jericho, every morning his wife noted that before daybreak, he would get out of bed and put on his tunic and leave the house. This went on for weeks. Finally, one morning, she decided she would get up and follow him and see where he was going. So she arose from her bed before daybreak, and she followed him out into the darkness of the city streets. And then she saw him. He was kneeling at the root of the old sycamore. Abraham got himself up early and returned to the place where he had stood before the Lord. Ralph Cushman wrote a long time ago, "I met God in the morning when the day was at its best and his presence came like sunrise, like a glory in my breast." Years ago as a boy, I used to hear every Sunday morning on the radio, because my dad always turned it on, a program from Cincinnati, Ohio, from Cadle Tabernacle. And Mrs. Cadle used to bring that program on the air by singing this song. "Ere you left your room this morning, did you think to pray? Did you see for loving favor as a shield today? Oh, how praying rests the weary. Prayer will turn the night to day. So when life seems dark and dreary, don't forget to pray." Now this verse, verse 27, is a prayer. It is a moment of devotion when Abraham stands before the Lord. Now please note in the song which Mrs. Cadle used to sing, and in the scripture verse here, we are reminded that prayer is not necessarily words. You do not have to be articulating something in order to be praying. Prayer is friendship with God. It is an attitude of your heart, disposition of your soul, the frame of your mind. It is something which goes on not just when you are articulating words with God, but when you're walking with God. So it isn't words, and Abraham wasn't saying anything. He just came and stood before God. Even prayer sometimes can become very hectic for us. It can become a hectic discipline, and it really shouldn't be that. I've always thought that prayer should be a quiet time, a time when we stand before the Lord. Now, of course, there are times when I get myself into trouble, and I come to God with my problems and my trouble, and I jabber a lot, because I feel that I have got to inform God, lest he not know. And God seems to say to me, though I have never heard his audible voice, God seems to say to me, "Calm down. I know all about this. Prayer must not be hectic." And yet I am coerced because I have a certain kind of temperament. And I find myself saying all the time, "Don't just stand there, do something." But God says to me, "Don't just do something, stand there. Be still and know that I am God." Abraham stood before the Lord. "Wait on the Lord, and he shall renew your strength, and you will mount up with wings of eagles." Elijah was fleeing from Jezebel, remember? He was fearful for his life, and he had run away and hidden in a cave. And he was saying to God, "They're all dead. All your prophets are gone. And I'm the only one left, and Jezebel is going to kill me." And the Lord said to Elijah, "Go forth and stand. Go forth and stand upon the mount before the Lord, and behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind rent the mountains and broke in pieces the rocks. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still small voice." And it was so, when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood in the entrance of the cave. And the still small voice was so small that Elijah only felt the vibrations where God had been. That's really what prayer is. It's waiting on the Lord. Now, I don't want to preach this morning, but when I talk about prayer, this is such a meaningful thing to me, and I want you to better understand what prayer really is. In the New Testament, we have the story of a man named Zacharias, who became the father of John the Baptist. And as I read the story, this is the way it comes through to me. Zacharias was so intent on having a son that every time he would go to the temple to burn incense, when it was his lot to do so, he would pray to God that same prayer. "Oh God, you are the creator of all. You are the sustainer of all. You are in charge. You have all power. I have no son. Please let me have a son." It went on and it went on and it went on. Until one morning in the temple, God said to Zacharias, "Zacharias, you are irritating me. You have asked for this over 100 times, All you needed to do was ask me once. I know what you want. Zacharias, you talk too much. Therefore, you are not going to be able to say anything for the next 9 months. Prayer is not talking to God. Prayer is simply being there in communion with God. And if you talk about the only thing you really need to say is, yes, yes, yes. Abraham was speechless when he stood there upon the mount and looked at the city of Sodom, which was now in waste, because he saw the condition of his world. Now, God and I do not talk a lot. I don't want you to misunderstand that statement. God and I do not talk a lot. Of course, my God and I walk through the fields together. We walk and talk as good friends should and do, but we don't really talk a lot. When I first became a Christian, I talked to God incessantly. Because, you see, I was afraid that God might not notice me. I wanted to be sure I got his attention, and so I talked and I talked, and God always listened. Isn't that wonderful? God always listened to my chattering. And then after walking with God now for over 50 years, I discovered that I talk a lot less to God, but God talks a lot more to me. I think that is growth. Talking less and listening more. Betty and I are, by nature, quiet people. And if you should slip in sometime at our home, you might find us for an hour or 2 hours, never saying a word to each other. And we're not angry, we're not mad. We just don't need to be talking all the time because we know one another is there. Of course, when Betty does talk, I always listen. And it is incredible how much I learn by just listening. Now, you may think that I'm the last of the mystics, and I may be, but every morning, literally, every morning, God says to me, good morning, Les. And I say, good morning, God. And a very good morning it is. That's what prayer is. I remember when my youngest daughter was very small. One day, she unceremoniously came across the room and just climbed up into my lap. And I said to her, Annie, what do you want? And she said, I don't want anything, Daddy. I just wanted to be with you. That's prayer. And that's the kind of thing that needs to go on all day long and all night long, when you're awake or when you're asleep. It makes no difference. We are people of prayer. So Abraham stood before the Lord in the early morning. Verse 28, and he looked toward Sodom and Gomorrah, and toward all the land of the plain, and behold, lo, the smoke of the country went up as the smoke of a furnace. The earth was charred, the walls were all down, the people were dead, the sky was black, the smell was horrific, and he stood there in silence, literally broken-hearted. Irma Bombeck was one of my favorite syndicated columnists. I love to read her columns. I love to read her books. Her life was full of disappointments, I suppose you know that, and yet she was such a delightful person, had such a sense of humor. She was so good at satire and comedy. She suffered through bouts of cancer. She had a mastectomy. She had kidney failure. Life was really difficult. Let her tell it in her own words. She said, I speak at college commencements and I tell everyone, I'm up here and you're down there, not because of my successes, but because of my failures. Then I proceed to spin all them off. A comedy record album that sold 2 copies in Beirut. A sitcom that lasted about as long as a donut in our house. A Broadway play that never saw Broadway. Book signings where I attracted 2 people. One who wanted directions to the restroom. And the other who wanted to buy the desk. What you have to tell yourself is this. I'm not a failure. I failed at doing something, but I'm not a failure. That's what Abraham had to convince himself of. He wasn't a failure. He failed at doing something, but he wasn't a failure. There's a big difference. Personally,
It's been a corduroy road. I've buried babies, lost parents, had cancer, worried over kids. The trick is to put it all in perspective, and that's what I do for a living. When I read that, I thought, this is wonderful, except for one word. She said she did that for a living. I do that for a life. And I might say that once you learn to do that, you have learned to leave it in the hands of God. And that's what Abraham had to do when he stood looking out over the charred ruins of the city of Sodom. And it came to pass, when God destroyed the cities of the plain, that God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow, when he overthrew the cities in which Lot dwelt. God granted his prayer as much as God could do. He couldn't save the city, but he could rescue Lot, even though Lot did not deserve it. He rescued Lot, not because Lot was deserving, but because of Abraham. I will do this, Abraham, for you. And this verse has God saying, I remember Abraham. What an honor it is for God to remember us. In chapter 17, verse 1, where Abraham is portrayed as one who has committed a grievous sin in the birth of Ishmael, after 13 years of silence when God didn't speak to him and he thought for sure that God had abandoned him, God said to him, Abraham, I have not forgotten you. I remember you. I will never forget you. Sometimes we think the country has lost its way, the country is in a terrible moral decline, and we say to God, I remember the day when this country was known all over the world as a Christian country, and God says, I remember that. And then we say to God, what about the church, Lord? The church is in a bad shape. We never hear the gospel anymore. It's been 15 years in my church since I heard the gospel, and God says, I remember that. Or it's been almost a month now since I lost my job, and the pantry is empty, and my children are crying, and God says, I remember. Or a man says, you know, my wife walked out on me a month ago, said she didn't love me anymore, and God says, I remember. And a father says, where is Susan? Susan's been gone for 4 years. She never writes this anymore. I never hear from her. My heart is broken. And God says, I remember. And a husband says, it's been 6 months since Mary went away, and I don't think I can ever get over this. In fact, it's hard for me to breathe. And God says, I remember. And a man says, God, just yesterday, my friend Jack was told he has inoperable cancer, and I have been weeping with the family. And God says, I remember. I know about this. God said to Abraham, I know your heart is broken, but I remember. I remember how you grieved for the city of Sodom. I remember that you did all anyone could possibly do, and I want you to know that Lot is okay. And I did this for you. I remember, Abraham. What a blessing it is to know that God never forgets us, that he remembers. And Lot went up out of Zoar and dwelt in the mountain, and his two daughters with him, for he feared to dwell in Zoar, and he dwelt in a cave, he and his two daughters. That's an interesting verse. Because when the angels led him out of the city of Sodom, he said, let me go to the little city of Zoar. I'm afraid to live in the mountains because the Sodomites blame me for what is happening. So God granted his request. Now he says, I'm afraid to live in Zoar because these people are blaming me too, so I must run to the mountains. You see, Lot was a wicked man. No matter how you interpret it, Lot was a very wicked man. He had done some wicked things, and God knew that. In mercy, God was sheltering him, but God knew that he was a wicked man. And the word wicked, as I pointed out yesterday, means to be out of place. Lot was out of place in God's world. He didn't seem to fit. He ran to Zoar, and then he ran to the mountain. No matter what he did, he was always running for his life, like a square peg in a round hole. He just didn't fit. Augustine once said, God has made us for himself, and we cannot find rest until we find our rest in God. And the firstborn said unto the younger, our father is old, And there is not a man in the earth to come in unto us after the manner of the earth. Come, let us make our father drink wine, and we will lie with him that we may preserve seed of our father. Now that wasn't exactly true. There were a lot of men left in the earth. Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed, but the Canaanite civilization was still intact. There were plenty of men. You see, that's what sin does to us. Sin exacerbates the problem. Once you sin, then you have to sin again, because sin begets sin, begets sin, begets sin, and we go from bad to worse. The best thing to do is to not get started with it. They got started with the compromise in the land of Sodom, and the result was they were so brainwashed that their father offered them as prostitutes to the angels who had come and to the men of the city, and they later degenerated into incest themselves. That's what sin does to us. And they made their father drink wine that night, and the firstborn went in and lay with her father. Verse 35, the younger arose and lay with him also. Verse 36, thus were both the daughters of Lot with child by their father. Now that's repulsive to us. It's repulsive to us because it is not a part of our moral understanding. It is repulsive to us because we are not aware, or we do not consider at least, that these people lived in a very primitive state at the very beginning of time. And that in the land of Sodom, there was no such thing as a law against incest. So they weren't really aware of how ridiculously repulsive this was or is to us today. And also, you have to remember, when you read these stories of the Old Testament about people whom God used, and you wonder how God could have done it with those people, you have to remember that we are dealing here with progressive revelation. God has been progressively revealing himself to man since the Garden of Eden, and he still is today, and he's not through with us. More and more, as we're capable of comprehending what God's will and purpose is, God reveals that to us. Adam sold out everything to the devil. He should have known better. He did know better. But God was starting with primitive embryonic man in the garden. And Noah? Well, when Noah came out of the ark, the first thing he did was to get drunk. And apparently there was some kind of an illicit relationship between him and his grandson Canaan, which smacks of homosexuality, which he didn't have anything to do with, but his grandson did. And Abraham, well, you remember Abraham had an affair with Hagar, his concubine, and produced Ishmael. And now Lot is having incestuous relationships with his own daughters. And Judah, who was the father of the tribe which brought the Messiah into the world, had a relationship with Tamar, his daughter-in-law, and that was later exposed to his shame. And David murdered Uriah, as well as having an affair with his wife Bathsheba. And Solomon, the wise man, had 700 wives and 300 concubines. And we look at all of this and we say, in spite of the good points of these people, they were a sorry lot. How did God do anything with this kind of people? And then I stop and I ponder and I say to myself, but we're a sorry lot too. How does God do anything with us? The progress is so slow. It's like a snail's pace. Once in a while, I have gotten these in the mail, once in a while you get a letter from the manufacturer of an automobile or an appliance, and it says there is a defect in what you have, and we are recalling this, and we're going to fix it for you. I wonder what would happen to this tabernacle this morning if God recalled all the defects. Well, I think I know. I think it would be absolutely empty. Because we're all defective people. My wife was on the computer last night. Computer is a wonderful thing. I still don't know how to operate a computer. But my wife loves them. We have three of them. She loves them. And last night she said, listen to this. And it was so interesting, I wrote it down. I thought I'd share it with you. The maker of all human beings is recalling all units manufactured regardless of make or year, due to the serious defect in the primary and central component of the heart. This is due to a malfunction in the original prototype unit code named Adam and Eve, resulting in the reproduction of the same defect in all subsequent units. This defect has been technically termed subsequential internal non-morality, or more commonly known as sin. The manufacturer, who is neither liable nor at fault, is providing factory-authorized repair and service free of charge to correct this sin defect. The repair technician, Jesus, has most generously offered to bear the entire burden of the staggering cost of the repairs. There is no additional fee required. Well, if God in the days of Abraham had called all the people back that had defects, they would have all been called back, and the same thing is true today. God is a God of patience and mercy. He is long-suffering. He deals with us where we are. Now, in verses 37 and 38, that story concludes with this. And the firstborn bare a son, that is, the younger daughter of Lot. The firstborn bare a son, the older daughter, and called his name Moab, the same as the father of the Moabites unto this day. And the younger, she also bare a son, and called his name Ben-Ammi, the same as the father of the children of Ammon unto this day. Now, the Moabites and the Ammonites lived on the east side of the Dead Sea. And when Joshua led the children of Israel, after their 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, into the conquest of the land of Canaan, Deuteronomy chapter 2 tells us that God specifically told Moses and Joshua that they were not to fight with the Moabites or with the Ammonites, because he had given them this territory, which shows that God is a merciful God even to those who are pagan. We hear no more of Lot after this story in the 19th chapter of Genesis. It's like Pontius Pilate. We hear no more of him except in the Creed. And there, every time we hear his name, it is associated with something terrible that he did in the crucifixion of Jesus. And Judas Iscariot, we don't hear any more about him after his terrible deed of perfidy and treachery against his master. This is what happened to Lot. He just disappeared from the scene. And Abraham journeyed from thence toward the south country and dwelled between Kadesh and Shur and sojourned in Gerar. Abraham had his headquarters during this period in three places. He lived in Bethel, he lived in Hebron, and he lived in Beersheba. Now he moves from Hebron south and west into the country of the Philistines along the edge of the Mediterranean Sea to a city called Gerar, and he gets himself into serious trouble. Abraham said of Sarah, his wife, "She is my sister," and Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. Now at this time, please note this. At this time, Sarah was 90 years old. At this time, Sarah was big with the pregnancy of Isaac. So you cannot begin to conceive that Abimelech desired Abraham's wife, Sarah. That happened all the time in these ancient days. But also, this kind of thing was done because kings would like to provide a covenant or a contract, an agreement, an alliance with somebody else, like a rich sheik as Abraham was. And so they did this by the exchange of women. These were gifts which helped to sign the contract, so to speak. And I think that's what happened here. But God came to Abimelech, and God here is Elohim, not Yahweh. This is the powerful God of the universe, the first God of the Old Testament, not Yahweh, the personal God of the Jews, because Abimelech didn't know that God. He only knew the God, the powerful God of the universe. God came to Abimelech in a dream by night and said to him, "Behold, thou art but a dead man, for the woman which thou hast taken, she is a man's wife." Now, does God speak to a pagan? Well, of course he does. Weren't we all pagans when God spoke to us? We may have been in a Christian country, but we were all pagans when God started dealing with us. And what's going on here? God says you are but a dead man because you have taken a man's wife. Does this mean that Abimelech was physically ill? He was almost dead. What was he thinking about? Or does it simply mean you're out of your mind to do a thing like this? Perhaps both. But Abimelech had not come near her, and he said, "Lord, wilt thou slay also a righteous nation?" Now, what's going on here? What's going on here is Abimelech remembers what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah, cities which just lay to the east of him a distance, and he's saying, "Would God do the same thing to us that he did to Sodom? Are you going to bring this curse upon us? Said he not unto me, 'She is my sister,' and she, even she herself, said, 'He is my brother'? In the integrity of my heart and the innocency of my hands have I done this." A righteous nation? Gerar, a pagan nation? A righteous nation? Well, in comparison, yes. Because in comparison, Abraham was perfect in his generation. He was the best God could find in his generation. In comparison, Lot was righteous among the people of Sodom. In comparison, the city of Gerar was righteous. In comparison only to the city of Sodom. And God said unto him in a dream, Yea, I know that thou didst this in the integrity of thy heart, for I also withheld thee from sinning against me, therefore suffered I thee not to touch her. When I read this story, I think to myself at first blush,
You made a terrible mistake, and I could have destroyed your country for it, but I know that you meant well, and you didn't mean to create this problem for yourself, for me, or for Abraham. You have to see what's going on here. The king of Gerar did not know Jehovah as Abraham did. He knew only Elohim, and thus his moral compass was inaccurate, but he wasn't aware that it was inaccurate. And the difference, the major difference between Abimelech, the good king, and Abraham, whom God has called, was that Abraham was going somewhere with God, and Abimelech was not. That is, Abimelech was of no service to God. God had found a good man in Abraham who could do what he wanted, but Abimelech, good man though he was not of this line of descent which God had chosen. God always looks at the future, you see. When God elects somebody to do something, he looks at the man's potential or the woman's potential, and he says, this is somebody I can use because there is the possibility of potential growth here. And obviously, there was no possibility of that kind of potential growth in the life of Abimelech. Now, therefore, restore the man his wife, for he is a prophet, and he shall pray for thee, and thou shalt live. Now, that's an interesting statement. We are told here that Abraham was a prophet. The word Navi in the Hebrew means one who speaks for God. We normally think of a prophet as being one who foretells the future, and that's a part of it. But essentially, the fundamental meaning of the word Navi is one who speaks for God, one who proclaims the word of God. And Abimelech here needed a mediator. He needed somebody to speak for God to him, just like the Israelites later needed somebody to speak for God to them. And so God gave them as a prophet, a spokesman, Moses. And God seems to be saying here to Abimelech, yes, Abimelech, I know that what Abraham has done is worse than what you did, but you have to understand he's the best I could find to do a job. Later on, God said to Moses, and have you ever understood this, or do you just pass over this? God said to Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, I will allow you a bill of divorce. God never sanctioned divorce. That is against God's law. It's against God's will. But God said, I have to deal with you where you are, progressively. At this point, I have to do this, because I cannot expect more of you than you can comprehend. How does God create the kingdom of God with such imperfect people? That's the big question. Well, I don't know what the answer to that is, except to say that he has to, because that's all he's got, is imperfect people. One day, it is God's dream to present his church to the Father without spot, without wrinkle, without blemish. But that day is far from here now. So, I say to people, be patient with me. God is not through with me yet. I am still under construction. God is revealing more and more of himself to me all the time, and I am trying to understand and to obey. Then Abimelech called Abraham and said unto him, what have you done unto us, and what have I offended you, that thou hast brought on me and on my kingdom this great sin? Now, when you compare Abimelech to the kings of Israel after the kingdom fell apart and was divided, at the death of Solomon, almost all of the 38 kings of Israel and Judah were worse, far worse than was this man Abimelech. And Abimelech said unto Abraham, what sawest thou that thou hast done this thing? Why did you do this? What were you thinking about? Did you think that you couldn't trust me, that I wouldn't do what was right if I knew the truth? You should know the reputation of the people of Gerar. We are honest people. And Abraham said, because I thought, surely the fear of God is not in this place, and they will slay me for my wife's sake. Well, off the top of his head, that was the best excuse that he could think of at the moment. And it was pretty indefensible, but that's what he said. I was afraid that you would take my wife, or if you didn't take my wife, you would kill me for her. And yet, indeed, she is my sister. She's the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother. And she became my wife. One thing I love about the Bible, and it's one book that does this better than any other book I've ever read. It is honest. The Bible is stark honesty. It portrays God's people with their warts just like they are. If they do wrong, it tells us they did wrong. If I had been God, perish the thought, but if I had been God and had been choosing people and writing a story about it, I would have been very particular and very discriminating about making sure that everything was just so-so. But God tells it like it is. And Abraham had lied. He didn't think he had, because he thought a half lie wasn't a lie. But a half lie is a lie as black as hell. And what is a lie? A lie is an intent to deceive. And you can do that without ever speaking a word. You can lie with your looks. You can lie with your attitude. And Abraham had lied. Now, what we do at a time like this is a very dangerous thing, because what we do is we try to define sin. And we always define sin to our own advantage. So we talk about sins of commission and sins of omission. Or we talk about intentional sin or unintentional sin. Or we say, sin is what you do and mistakes, that's what I do. But the sum of the whole picture is found in the word hamartia in the New Testament, which is the root basic word for sin, and it means to miss the mark. Paul says we all fall short of the glory of God. Present tense, not past. We do it all the time. We all fall short of the glory of God. We never measure up to God's standard of righteousness or his standard of perfection. We are all in arrears. We all fall short. Abraham fell short. I fall short, and I'm sorry to punch a hole in your balloon, but so do you. And Abimelech took sheep and oxen and men servants and women servants and gave them unto Abraham and restored him Sarah his wife. And Abimelech said, behold, my land is before you. He acknowledges that he's done wrong, and he says, you are free to this land. And incidentally, that's why Abraham traveled all over Canaan, because he was driving down his stakes. He was claiming the territory for him and his descendants. And unto Sarah he said, behold, I have given thy brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Behold, he is to thee a covering of the eyes unto all that are with thee and with all other. Thus she was reproved. That is a difficult verse. In fact, it is very obscure in the Hebrew. And you will not find two Hebrew scholars who agree on what this verse says. What is it that he said to Sarah? Let's see if we can untangle it, and it will simply be one of the possibilities, because not all will agree with this. He said to Sarah, behold, I have given your brother, notice he calls him your brother, this husband, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. That was quite a large sum of money. That was his total gift. And behold, he is to thee a covering of the eyes unto all that are with thee. Which sounds like, from the English translation here, that he is saying, Abraham will take this money as my gift to him and will recognize that he must buy you a veil to cover your face so that you will be protected from the lustful ambitions of all those around you. Now, that's one possibility. But it's also possible that what it says is, behold, it is to thee a covering of the eyes. That is, the $1,000 will buy a veil and it will cover the eyes, not you. I rather think that's a better understanding of it, because Abraham hadn't done a very good job protecting her so far, and why would Abimelech think he was going to do that now? And then it says, and with all other, thus she was reproved, which doesn't make any sense at all. Now, if you go back to the Septuagint says, in all things speak the truth, which seems to be exactly the content or the attitude of this verse. If that is true, then it is a devastating indictment of Abraham by a pagan. Pagan says to him, I'm going to give you $1,000 to make amends for what I have done wrong, even though what you did was worse than what I did. And you can take this $1,000 and buy yourself, your wife, a veil to cover her face so that others will not lust for her, and that will protect her. And for God's sake, Abraham, in all things from here on, speak the truth. If you're going to tell me that this is your sister, tell me also that this is your wife. My friends, it is a terrible thing to think about, that the world very often rightly serves an indictment upon the Church of Jesus Christ. A Hindu once said to E. Stanley Jones in India, if you expect us to believe in your Christ, then you have got to be more Christ-like. And the world says to us every day, we look at you and we don't see any difference between you and us. You're just like we are. Why should we be Christians when we don't see any difference? So Abimelech, a pagan, said to Abraham, if you're going to be God's man, be God's man. Speak the truth. Live the truth. Admit the truth. Even if it means that you may be a martyr by doing so, and that's what Abraham was afraid of when he lied about his wife. And right here I want to say, I don't know at this point why Sarah lived with him. I can't understand why Sarah didn't leave him. Any husband that would allow his wife to be taken by a king and put in a harem to protect his own skin didn't deserve a good wife. But God is working on both of them. And as you read the story, you discover that things do get better. And that's our hope. Thank you very much. Have a good day.